Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, including album reviews, concert reviews, and this week in music history, which is what we are bringing to you today. If you would like to help out our show, of course, go to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that Amazon banner on the right-hand side. It'll take you to Amazon, do all of your normal shopping, and it will not cost you anything extra to go through our site, but we get a little bit of money back just for whatever it is that you purchase. It's really simple. It's really easy. So go through the website, click on that banner, or go just through followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Also, I'd like to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You rock.
You rock.
Along with me, of course, is the one and only Greg Harvey.
Hey, that's me.
And also bringing you to tonight's episode is Jake, or is it Yoda, Crumb?
Questions have you.
Dun, dun, dun. So which is it?
I mean, right now.
You told
now.
Me this.
Right.
You told me this.
Yes.
So I want to hear this story, actually. Before we get into the music Jesus. And the history.
All right.
What is the story behind Jake slash possibly Yoda, Crumb?
Well, as legend would have it, right, my parents were on board with naming me Yoda.
Really?
Yes. That was the plan. That was what was going to happen. So the question, I know you're like, were your parents just really cool or were they really high? And I don't know because I was still in utero. I can't give you an opinion on that. However, Grandma Crumb thought they were just really dumb and convinced them like in the zero. My mom says she spent like 22 hours in labor with me. So like after 22 hours of trying to birth a child, like I guess your willpower is gone. So like the paper came back and she convinced them that like Yoda wasn't Catholic enough. It wasn't Christian enough.
No, I would have to agree with Grandma.
So you are only detractor number three, Greg.
I mean, I'm fine with you being named Yoda. I'm just saying that if they were going for something Christian, steering away from a mythical sci-fi yes. 70s film, probably would well, be a little the blasphemous.
The origins of how Yoda happened, there are two different stories on that. And one is my mother just thought it sounded really German. And two is my dad made a joke about Yoda when my mother had a night terror about, because like everyone when they're pregnant, they have nightmares about birthing something inhuman.
Whoa.
Makes sense.
Yeah, like to a person. Like I have yet to meet. Oh yeah, heck, did you have nightmares about having
wow. That's
a body horror child.
That's a whole different dimension that like is probably a very common reality amongst women, and yet like as a man, I did not know that. Yeah. But I'm going to have to ask some of the mothers in my life about that and see what they say.
Well,
is that an awkward, is that a faux pas conversation?
No, just segue right into it, you know?
No, when you
Mom,
bring it up.
Mom, it's seriously. So good to see you. Hey, did you ever think I was going to be born like a hoofed...
a mutant demon?
Goat cyclops?
No, seriously, if you bring it up, did you have like nightmares about birthing something inhuman or like a little monster when you were pregnant? All women will go,
she'd be like, that happened.
Yes,
it came
yes,
true.
I did. And they'll be like, oh, you understand. And that's like a point to connect.
Wow.
On.
Wow.
To a T.
Anything to help me understand, I guess.
In fact, if you find someone whose family is really closed off and they don't like have like communication between, you might be the only person they ever talk to about that.
Interesting.
So wow. There you go, Greg.
Okay. So welcome to Follow the Sound.
Yay.
I'm Brian Kroc, Greg Harvey, and Jacob Crumb. So, sorry for the little side note that we went there. I had to know the story behind this because he messaged me in the middle of the night saying that he could have possibly been named Yoda. So, yeah, there you go. But let's go ahead and do music history now. We are going from January 29th through February 2nd, right? That sound right?
Yes.
Yes.
5 days of action-packed music history.
Yes. So,
kicking off.
Starting off on the 29th, we got a nice one here. 1961, Bob Dylan visits Woody Guthrie at Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital in New Jersey, where Guthrie is being treated for Huntington's disease. Dylan plays him a song to Woody, which appears on his first album, his first album the following year.
Well, that's sweet that he wrote him a song.
Yeah.
For for having Huntington's disease.
I mean, he flat out said that, you know, Woody Guthrie is the reason why he got into music in the first place. So because he was just going through, he was listening to some stuff, and somebody was like, hey, have you ever listened to Woody Guthrie? And he goes, no. And then somebody put on a Woody Guthrie record, and it, like, blew him away.
Wow.
And so that's exactly how he got into music.
Hmm. Oh.
He followed the sound of Woody Guthrie.
Oh. Well, we might as well keep moving.
Yes.
Way up, jumping to 2008, progressive rock band the Mars Volta released their album, The Bedlam in Goliath. As a promotion, the band also gives away a CD vinyl single, a special format with an optical side, readable in CD players, and a vinyl side that plays on a turntable for about 3 minutes. Cool concept, right? Both sides contain a cover of Pink Floyd's Candy and a current bun.
Wow.
Wow. I have never, even since this story, I don't think I've ever heard of such a thing. That's awesome to have one side a playable CD and yet the other side you can still drop a needle on it. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty groovy.
I love when bands do just crazy ideas like that.
Yeah, why not?
It's clever marketing.
Well, and like some people think it's like old formats and, you know, it's stupid promotion. But I mean, it gets you talking because I know a lot of bands that are into like releasing their music just on cassette tape. And like in a way, nobody's really going to listen to it. No offense, guys. But like the fact that when you show up with your merch booth and you're like, our CD's $10 or for $5, you can get the cassette tape. And just the cassette tape alone is kind of like, what? You're doing that? Yeah, maybe I will buy your cassette tape for some random reason.
You know, it's funny. I actually, I do buy the vinyl for a lot of bands that I like,
mm-hmm.
mainly because I know I'm going to get a digital download anyway,
That's
which
true.
Is really what I want to listen to it, but I want the vinyl so I can either like have them sign it or I can put it on my wall. Yeah. Or I can add it to my record collection. Like, to me, the album, like vinyl, is a lot more substantial and a lot cooler to have. Also, if treated right, it'll last dang near forever.
Yeah.
Well, CDs will actually fade after a while. They don't last forever, but vinyl will last a long time.
Well, there's something to be said.
If treated properly.
I'm just going to say that CDs. Most manufacturers have solved the problem. You're talking about how the resin that binds the glass to the metallic surface yellows,
yes,
and cracks, and
well, and also the way that they're burned on there, it's the actual part of it that the information is recorded on degrades after 15 to 20 years.
Well, okay. Some manufacturers have solved that problem.
Well, I mean, it's also the same thing, though, with hard drives, is that eventually hard drives, even if not used, if just stuck in storage, will degrade over time. Like it's just how the system goes. But vinyl has been proven to last longer than all of them.
Well, there's something to be said about having...
Except for tape in a vacuum, which for some reason doesn't seem to ever go bad.
Hmm.
You know how I know that?
Space.
Voyager still functions off of tape data.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
it's not an issue. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
I bet those gold CDs last longer than vinyl.
The anyway. Gold records?
Yeah.
That have a couple of music records. Selections on them, including the one and only Chuck Berry.
Ooh.
That is true.
I forget what Chuck Berry song it is, though.
I think it's Roll Over Beethoven.
Is it? It should be.
Yeah.
Well, all I was going to say was that having the vinyl is always superior because just being able to hold it
yes.
for the reasons you said, you know, mount it on your wall, have the artwork, you get yes. almost like a souvenir out of your music
exactly,
purchase.
Exactly.
Because MP3s, you have the song, but what else do you have? You know, you can't flip through the liner
art,
book.
You know, that's like just a,
yeah. Yeah.
A little box of the image of the album cover.
I mean, people but, love to take the albums and use them as art, so and now you yes. can't do that with MP3s.
On top of that, I also want to point out the Mars Volta are honestly one of the most technically proficient bands to ever exist. They're brilliant in the way that they play, the way that they perform, the way that they write music. Like it's almost symphonic on like the level of complexity that they put into their music.
It's hectic.
It's like Rush, except like way more complex. And the drummer is just stupid awesome. So, yeah, the Mars Volta, really great band. If you have not heard of them, check them out, please. Jake, what do we got next?
2011 Megapython versus Gatoroid debuts on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Welcome to Follow the Film with Jacob Crum.
Well, here's the tie-in.
What do we got?
The film stars Tiffany and Debbie Gibson.
Hmm.
Now, previously, Tiffany had been cast in Mega Piranha.
Mega Piranha.
Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah, well, Debbie was cast in Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
But Mega Python versus Gatoroid was the first and only film featuring the duo, both as protagonist, because, you know, the monsters in the title are the antagonists.
Yes. Okay. Together. Right. On one screen.
Yeah, and there's some pretty funny dialogue from it that kind of gives a nod back to some of their lyrics. In fact, they have a fight scene together, and before the fight scene starts, Gibson quips, "You're gonna get it, you gator-baiting bitch!" Which Tiffany says, "Only in your dreams."
Yes.
Right? And then later, after the fight is over, Gibson says, "I think we're alone now." And Tiffany replies with, "There doesn't seem to be anyone around."
Wow.
And last week we talked about how Tiffany was, at the time when her album came out, that she was the youngest female recording artist to have a number one album.
Yes.
Well, Gibson is still the youngest female singer to sing and write a number one.
Oh, nice.
With Foolish Beat in 1988.
Interesting.
Wow. Very talented. And now her movie career is taking off, fighting giant creatures.
Yes.
And well, giant creatures made of two creatures.
A Gatoroid and a Megapython.
Yeah.
Fighting each other while people watch and die.
I think that's two robots.
I'm just saying, it's no...
Yeah, it's two robots.
It's no, you know, it's no...
Sharknado,
but
it's kind of the same vein. It's just that somebody created a giant.
That's one company. That's all they do. All they do is those movies. So yeah, they're hilarious.
Well, Roger Corman's done a few of them.
Yes, Roger Corman has done a few of them, but the production company was that production company. Because I watched a documentary about those guys, and they just—that's all they do are the really bad, cheesy, like, weird horror type movies like that. And a bunch of the other random ones too. So it's like, if you ever see like, they had, what was the one movie that came out a while ago? It was like World War Z or whatever with Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Well, there was another one that was called like a Z War or something like that.
Yeah.
It's the same company. It's like they just produce movies that all come out at the same time as like the other popular movies, in hopes that people will rent them thinking that they're the other movie.
Radioactive Chipmunk versus the Toxic Turtle.
Something like that.
Dun,
yes.
Dun, dun.
All right, let's go ahead and move on.
Hang on.
What?
We're totally brushing over my favorite one of these films.
Okay,
or
yes.
Or my favorite character in these films.
Okay.
Which is Sharktopus.
Oh, yes, yes.
Shark.
Head of a shark, body of an octopus.
Right, yes.
Sharktopus.
Yes, and he's fought several other, like, fish creatures, including Terracuda.
Ooh, Terracuda.
Yeah. Love it. Keep making them. Just keep making
them. What is that, a tuna and a barracuda?
Yeah, I think Piranaconda.
Oh, Piranaconda.
Piranaconda is my favorite title, though.
That sounds like a band name.
Piranaconda?
Piranaconda. So.
Monkey Squid.
Come see this weekend, Piranaconda and the Ringo Starr's All-Star Band.
Okay.
That's
a concert I want to see.
Let's move on to birthdays,
Jake.
Happy
birthday.
What do you got?
Ooh, happy birthday. 1933, born... Ron Townsend, the R&B singer from Fifth Dimension, St. Louis's own Ron.
Ron Townsend. Happy birthday, Ron.
Happy birthday, Ron.
Happy birthday, Ron Townsend. Another son of St. Louis. You gotta congratulate those guys. You gotta praise them.
Praise him.
Yes.
Happy birthday.
So let's go ahead and move on to January 30th. The original Dixieland Jazz Band records the Darktown Strutters Ball. Interestingly, though, the Dixieland Jazz Band was the first to record jazz. They were the second to take a swing at the Shelton Brooks standard. And the six Brown Brothers cut vinyl 3 weeks earlier, though, on May 9th.
Wow.
So there you go.
First to record jazz.
Yes. First to record jazz, but it could have been recorded well before then. Because, I mean, obviously, it's 1917. Mm-hmm. It could have been recorded numerous times before then. It's just that most of the jazz people, like, refused to do it because they felt jazz was an improvisational art form and therefore couldn't be properly recorded. The same thing was said about hip-hop much, much later on. It was recorded and became a huge deal.
It's just a free flow. You can't record that. You can't capture that energy.
Yes.
Well, they did.
That's a really recognizable jazz standard.
Yes. The Darktown Strutter's mm-hmm. Ball? Yeah.
Sometimes it's just called Strutter's Ball. Sometimes it's, Strutter's Ball.
How's that one go again?
It starts off like with a triangle and a couple rim shots and features pretty heavy on the rim shot. And
really,
I can't do a 15-piece band without multi-track recording, Greg. I'd have to listen to the piece again.
All right, fine. I'll have to just look that one up. So there we go. The Darktown Strutter's Ball.
Yeah. All right, what do we got next?
1961, the songwriting team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller announced that they are forming their own independent production company. And no talent was ever safe again because they got like everyone to write for them mm-hmm. and that production company. And of course, everyone here is familiar with Lieber and Stoller's work because they wrote like a third of everything you've ever heard in the 50s.
Yep. And the 60s.
And pretty much everything Phil Spector recorded in the 60s
yep.
had their hands on it somewhere.
Wow.
Everything along with the Wrecking Crew and everything out on the West Coast.
Yes.
Yes. It's that's just how it was back then. So
dynamic duo.
All right.
Wow.
Flying on. Let's move on to the next little fact here. Greg, what you got?
Well, the year was 2015, so not too long ago here.
Yeah.
Record producer Suge Knight is arrested in Los Angeles on suspicion of murder.
Yup.
The day after he was involved in a hit and run that killed his friend Terry Carter and injured actor Clea Danielle Sloan. Is that right?
I think you got it.
Oh, we don't know. I'm sorry about that, Sloan. nonetheless, though, Knight was on the set of the NWA biopic that was Straight Outta Compton, which was a great movie and a great biography of sorts, when he allegedly argued with two men, then followed them to a burger joint where he ran them down in a parking lot. Witnesses claim he then even backed over the victims with his truck before leaving the scene. But of course, Knight's lawyer insists he was fleeing for his own safety. Whoa.
As one does.
So a lot going on there. I mean, of course, Suge Knight, heavily involved with the Tupac murderer conspiracy. Some people blame him for what happened, and to this day, it's still possible that he could have been setting up his buddy Tupac.
Have you been following his trial at all? Because it's still going on.
This one we're talking about?
Right here.
No.
Oh, yeah. So he originally was held on like a $25 million bond. And then,
he paid it in cash.
And then he fired his legal team two or three times. And then in court, passed out when the judge denied his bail.
Hmm.
And so then they set his trial off for like a year because he was in bad health, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, recently, as of like this week, so they arrested his lawyers and then charged them with witness tampering and like threatening to kill people if they testified and trying to bribe and buy off witnesses.
Wow.
Set their bail for $1 million and then just release them.
Hmm.
This trial is the biggest, weirdest circus. And now we're going on 3 years.
Wow.
Of everything. It would be the longest biopic in history if they just did the Suge Knight trial.
Wow.
And the OJ trial was a 10-episode season.
Yes, that's true.
Huh. The People versus OJ Simpson. Yes. So the next one's going to be the People versus Suge Knight.
I think it's going to be Suge Knight versus the world.
Well, Suge Knight versus the world.
That's perfect, too, because I was just thinking, like, this would make a good kind of parallel or a follow-up, just like the O.J. Simpson stuff just did a few years ago, where, you know, Suge Knight, we have the old history there, you know, but now something new has come up, and so back in the spotlight here, and it does, it kind of follows a similar O.J. story.
Oh, that's right. I was forgetting about the leaked video. So some of the witnesses for this, their names have been sealed in court documents. And when you have a sealed court document like that, nobody even knows where they're at. Like, they don't just have, like, oh, here's sealed records that go along with the judge's paperwork everywhere the trial goes. No. So anyway, then someone in the Justice Department sold the videotape of him running it over, running people over to TMZ.
Oof.
For a ridiculous amount of money.
Wow.
Yeah, and of course, like, the everyone found out who that was. This whole thing has been crazy.
Wow.
But there is a legit concern that, like, if the witnesses' names ever get out, that Suge Knight could just have him killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
honestly, I would not want to mess with Suge Knight, regardless, because you might get messed up.
True.
Pretty bad. Pretty bad.
Let's go ahead and move on to the birthdays.
Okay.
For January 30th. Let's see. 1936, German jazz pianist Horst Jankowski is born in Berlin. Horst, best known for the tune, is A Walk in the Black Forest. But if you have ever been in an elevator that played music, I am sure you are familiar with his work. It goes a little something like this. That's nice and pleasant. You know what I love about that, actually, is the fact that it's like the drummer is just doing the hi-hat and like going to town there. The bass is literally just hitting on the one and the three, and the boom, guitar boom. Is doing the snare, just doing that.
Yeah, that was a very peaceful tune ski. And you didn't even know what language it was in. It was all instrumental.
It was all in German instrumental.
Yes. You got to translate that German piano.
Yes, yes, yes. That's how it goes.
No, that was good.
So yeah, happy birthday to Horst Jankowski from Berlin.
Happy birthday. Our next birthday on this list. This singer was born the same year as I. How appropriate. The year was 1989. Singer Samantha Fish is born in Kansas City, Missouri.
Ooh.
Yeah, and depending on when you catch this show, she may be or has just played the old Rock House in St. Louis on February 1st. So before our week in history is even over, she'll have played that show.
Yes. That is true. If you catch this show when it's posted, then you might get a chance to actually catch that show. So,
yeah, just depends how quickly Brian gets this one up, I guess.
It'll be up, tomorrow. So that'll be, what, the 31st.
So listen to it quickly so you can turn around and go to the show.
Yes, exactly. Excellent. So you'll have a good, like, 48 hours to... Not 48, no, like 26 yeah. hours.
Something tells me you probably missed the show. I'm just going to put 30, it out there.
32 hours to actually go out and catch this show. So I'm sure somebody will actually listen to it. But
oh, well, I love Samantha Fish.
Yes.
And as many people have pointed out, and we've probably already said it in our Grammy review show, the electric guitar is dying. And if anyone can bring it back, I think she can. And if anyone can bring blues back, I think she can.
Anyway. Well, there you go. All right. So, moving on up to January 31st, 1963, Neil Young, who was a young 17 at the time, plays his very first show, performing at a country club in Winnipeg, Canada.
Canadians.
Which I only know one person from Winnipeg. Never met him in my life.
Triple H?
But I know him via talking online.
Is it wrestler Triple H?
How's it going, Ty? I know you're out there. You're probably playing some Conan right now.
Is it Justin Bieber?
No. but yeah, that's really cool though. That's when he played his very first show at the age of 17. I wonder what he sounded like at that time.
You can find out.
Oh, really?
And I'll tell you exactly.
There's a clip of it.
You go to Neil Young archives, and he has recordings, not of this show.
Oh, okay.
But of his band from 1963.
Oh, nice.
I think they were called the Searchers, the Seekers.
I'm sure that's something like that. Yeah.
Hmm.
Interesting. I'm going to have to check that one out.
Yeah, it's really wild to listen to a 17 or 18-year-old Neil Young. Wait. Also, I'm totally diving into the Neil Young archives, and you should too. Everything he's ever recorded is on there.
Yes. Wow.
And right now, you can just access it. You just go there. You just go there.
Just do it. Okay. Well, enough talking. More action, huh?
What do we got next, Jake?
Ah, here we are. 1979. Bo Diddley opens for The Clash at the beginning of their U.S. tour.
How?
How did they do that?
How did they get Bo Diddley?
Why?
How?
Why?
Because Bo Diddley is punk as hell.
Well.
Okay. I guess, yeah. I mean, in that time frame, you know, The Clash, they definitely were still in like that 80s punk vibe, which were generally shorter songs, which were taken right out of rock and roll.
And Bo Diddley probably helped The Clash break into certain venues as well, and vice versa, I'm sure.
Maybe. So The Clash had sold some of their music, but they came on and opened up their show with I'm So Bored with the USA. That's how they opened the show.
Well,
nice.
Which is pretty awesome.
Join the club, buddy. Just kidding.
All right, let's move on to the birthdays of January 31st.
Okay, well, this first one comes from 1956. Born on this day is John Joseph Lydon in Holloway, London, England.
Who might that be, Greg?
Who is better known as Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols.
Yes.
Johnny Rotten, and who gets sung about by Neil Young. Hey, there you go.
That is nice.
Did he have anything good to say?
Let's see. Hey, hey. My. Yeah, that's it. Something about Johnny Rotten. I don't know. It's in the song. Go listen to it. Anyways, happy birthday, Johnny Rotten, who has always lived up to his name of being freaking disgusting.
Did you ever hear how he actually got the gig for singing in the Sex Pistols?
No.
So they had they were trying to find like a good singer to be the front man of the band, and he showed up. And basically the only way that they could test if he could actually sing was to play a song on the jukebox. And as the guitar player put it, he put the song on and then sang the piss out of it.
All right.
And that was his audition to get into the Sex Pistols.
I knew it had something to do with piss or, you know.
there had to be, right?
Because it's Johnny Rotten. He's gross.
Here's the other thing that I knew about the Sex Pistols. They were actually scared of the Ramones because they thought the Ramones were a real gang.
Hmm. That's cool.
Also, the Ramones were well known for putting a tiny little bit amount of pee in someone's beer.
Yeah.
I don't know how to take that news.
Ew.
I don't know if that makes me like them more.
Sid Vicious when he showed up.
Oh, I would too.
They gave him beer with a little bit of pee in it.
I would have done
just
that
just a little
too.
Bit of my pee.
Mm-hmm. I would still give Johnny Rotten just a whole cup of piss and see how much of it he got down before he realized it wasn't beer.
Jeez.
That, I don't like Johnny Rotten.
I've said it before.
That's the takeaway.
I've said it before on this show, and I will say it again, though. Johnny Rotten had like the best closing line for ending the Sex Pistols like tour and their time as a band together. And it was when they finished the show, and he said something along the lines of, "Do you ever get the feeling like you're being ripped off?" And then dropped the mic. That was it. That's how the Sex Pistols broke up on stage.
I'll give them that. That's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it. In America, too. They broke up in America,
right.
And then that was the end of that.
We drove them apart.
Good.
Drove them apart.
No, you guys are terrible. All right, we got another.
I have to do a rewind real quick.
Go ahead.
I wanted to plug another website during the Bo Diddley and the Clash story.
Okay, what you got?
Gig Archive.
Gig Archive.
I know it's also got archive in it, but it's a great website you can go to, and if you have like pictures from a concert, they have every concert date from most artists. Like, you go there, you're like, well, how many shows did the Clash play in 1977? You can go and count them. They have them all listed. You got pictures? You can put up a picture.
Do you have an actual website, like gigarchive.com, or I'll take that as a no.
No, I don't right now.
I'm trying to find it, because I found the Edinburgh Gig Archive, if you're wondering.
You know what? Actually, right now, maybe they didn't pay their bills, and that site doesn't exist anymore. Never mind.
Ah, well, it might come back.
All right. So, hey, this has been a fun trip through Jake's memories of GeoCities.
Yeah. Rumor has it.
GeoCities. That's great.
Hey, we all can get back onto the birthdays.
Go ahead for birthdays.
1964, the very prolific music and video director Sophie Muellerus was born in St. Pancras, London, England. She got her start in the music biz directing several promos for the Eurythmics and their lead singer Annie Lennox before bringing her talent to a wide variety of acts, which included No Doubt, Sarah McLachlan, Beyonce, Rihanna, Birdie, Garbage, Radiohead, and Kings of Leon. So if you like, if you were watching music videos in like the late 90s,
yes,
you've seen her work.
That's excellent. Well, it's quite the
wide range there. Clearly, like 90s was like the 90s alternative was the peak, but then you have like Kings of Leon thrown in there too. So.
Yeah, she did the Tragic Kingdom video for No Doubt.
Ooh,
cool.
That's a good one.
Yeah, she has kind of this like super saturated color style that sort like if you think of Radiohead, you're like, what was the brightest video they did? It was hers.
Yeah. All right.
Same thing with the Radiohead, the Eurythmics.
Then which Kings of Leon song did she do?
Good question. I don't know.
Like Use Somebody and Sex on Fire are real dark and
yeah, they are.
So it wouldn't have been one of those. Maybe it was even before then. Maybe it was something like Tape or Jean Girl, or because that's a pretty bright video. I don't know. I'm strolling through my head like because I've seen every single Kings of Leon video out there.
That's a good question. I probably should have looked that up before I came in the studio today. I should have anticipated you were going to ask that.
That's fine. Because I'm a big fan of Kings of Leon.
I do.
So. But yeah, let's go ahead and move on, I think, because we're going to February 1st now,
yes.
Right? Yes, February 1st.
A new day, same old artist. This time in 1972, Neil Young releases the album Harvest.
Yes.
Which, of course, has the hit Heart of Gold. After injuring his back trying to move some timber, very Canadian thing to do, Young started making the album in February 1971 when he wrangled a Nashville studio and some local musicians for a weekend and recorded the songs Old Man and Heart of Gold.
Now, this was the thing that really made Neil Young like famous in America, right? With like Old Man?
I feel like for me personally, yes. I mean, those are both great songs that I'm familiar with from Neil Young.
See, but those are the ones that I remember him performing, like, on stage and stuff, like, on TV shows, was him doing Old Man. And
yeah.
Old
Man, look at my But supposedly, as legend has it, the reason that he was playing acoustic, even though he had done electric albums before that, was simply because it was a lighter guitar and easier on his back in the studio.
Oh, interesting.
So, and you think of all the lyrics and the songs that came out off of that album, they're all kind of about, like, the fragility of life.
Yeah, but Heart of Gold, that was the album that really like made him a superstar in America.
Well, to reiterate what Jake just said too is that, you know, he gets known for doing acoustic guitar because he couldn't even play the electric at the time. And so he puts out this album with these these mellow acoustic kind of songs and suddenly he's iconic for it, and it was all because out of necessity. So that's interesting.
I should actually rephrase that, and that is when he was writing the songs, his back was injured.
Yes. Right?
It wasn't like, hey, in studio, we're just going to switch to acoustic. It was just that, well, my back's so sore, I can't Like,
well, yeah.
I don't have the inspiration to go and play.
Yeah, but the injury is what caused him to do these acoustic songs. Yeah. So it's just kind of funny how that works out.
I just realized I was phrasing it and like alluding and putting picture in people's brains that was completely inaccurate.
Sometimes you say things that are confusing, Jake. Yeah,
fair enough.
That's not...
Most days.
Oh.
All right.
There you go. Neil Young, first concert, and his
acoustic.
Iconic album, Harvest, in the same week.
Yeah. Very cool.
Nice.
So you know that means that I've got to stick Neil Young's picture on the post.
Oh, sure. That's fine. We haven't put his picture up yet.
No, that's true. I just don't know if I'm going to do old Neil Young or
both.
Young Neil Young.
Maybe both.
side by side. The life of Neil Young.
Yeah, there you go. You should make a gif of him aging.
Let's go ahead and move on to the birthdays, though.
Ah, I love this. 1937, Ray Sawyer, better known as Eye Patch of Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, is born in Chickasaw, Alabama. Now, Dr. Hook, if you're not familiar with that band, they were kind of billed as an outlaw country band, but they sounded a whole lot more like soft rock.
Mm.
And soft rock in the 70s when, like, nobody was doing that. So, you know, just like the rebelness of doing something different, I appreciate. However, their lyrics were actually written by a poet named Shel Silverstein.
And, Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they have like, you know, these really like waxing, waning kind of talk about things that are lost or overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
So I always liked them.
That's a very Silverstein outlook on life, too, is kind of the really dark side of a happy story.
Yes.
You know, like the meaning is very dark, but they cover it up with like, oh, you know, it's happy, bright, you know, almost like Dr. Seuss-y, except way more sadistic.
Right. Much like a song that now Ray Sawyer, Mr. Eye Patch, was not the lead singer of Dr. Hook. He was just a singer. However, he did sing their biggest song, which was the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
A song about how...
they want to be famous and make it onto the cover of Rolling Stone.
Right. And all the trials and tribulations. But it'll be fine when we're on the cover, right?
Yes.
That's cool.
Which actually, surprisingly, the only time that... the first time I heard that song was in the movie Almost Famous.
Oh, really?
When they announce that they're going to make the cover of Rolling Stone, they start singing it when they're sitting down at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow. It's like, I didn't even realize that somebody had written a song about that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, okay, so to Ray Sawyer and why he has an eye patch, he wasn't born with one eye. That actually came from a car accident. He had decided that he was going to quit music and drive up to Portland and become a lumberjack. Because that's what you do when you're tired of playing in dive bands. But he, on the way up there, before he even made it out of Texas, he got in a car accident and lost his eye. And then he said, well, I guess the universe wants me to be a musician.
Hmm.
So now, well, recently, in the last few years, there's actually been two Dr. Hooks touring. One with Ray Sawyer that's billed as Dr. Hook with Ray Sawyer. And then the other lead singer, Dennis, he tours as Dr. Hook and something else. I don't really remember what. Sometimes it's not the Medicine Show because that was that band, but.
Well, I just am tickled to the, you know, the fact that Ray Sawyer, you're in this band and you're not typically like the lead singer, but yet your song that you sing is the big hit. Oh, yeah. You want to talk about some band drama? I'm the lead singer and you sang my song. I've been in those bands before.
However, I don't think it's the song that's made the band the most money. Because I'm trying. There's another song they have that's in a lot of movies that I'm sure the licensing for that is actually what's still keeping them afloat.
Probably.
Keeping the royalty checks rolling in.
Royalty checks, baby!
Moving on up to 1948. James Ambrose Johnson Jr. is born in Buffalo, New York. James Ambrose Johnson Jr. is better known as Rick James.
I'm Rick James.
So there, yeah, that's all I got. It's Rick James.
Happy birthday, Rick James.
I mean, there's nothing else that really needs to be said about Rick James. It's Rick James. Everybody knows who Rick James is, especially now after the Chappelle Show.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it so funny that story has
that's the
has
lasting
eclipsed,
legacy
yeah,
of Rick
that's
James.
Eclipsed his music career?
Because it was him. He was actually on the show. That's what made it hilarious. It was Rick James in his own words when he's like, cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Wow. Well, I
like F your couch.
My favorite thing for that entire sketch, though, is the ridiculous hairpiece that Charlie Murphy is wearing. That like Jerry Curl hairpiece looks so bad. It is awful. They bought that thing for $2 at a Halloween shop down the street. Wow. Anyway,
I can't believe we just talked. We just said happy birthday, Rick James, and then talked about the sketch from the Chappelle Show.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's an eclipse to his career.
I'm Rick James has eclipsed Rick James.
Well, I mean, you can always Google these people, too. We're so good at what we do here.
That is true. That is true. Moving on up. What do
okay,
we got?
Okay, well, we got another birthday. In 1975, there's a future member, I will say, not when he was born, but he went on to become one half of the hip-hop duo Outkast, born Antoine Andre Patton in Savannah, Georgia. Not Andre 3000, but the other one, Big Boy.
You're telling me they got two Andres?
They're both Andre? Well, but Antoine Andre. So, not Andre 3000.
Mm. But I would have named them Andres.
Yeah. Yeah, Outkast Andres.
Andres.
Yes. Well, nonetheless, though, Big Boy, an important half of the group, the producing half. Of course, Andre 3000 is kind of the wordsmith. And Big Boy is the beat maker, the hit maker, pumping out your speaker box. Good stuff. And, well, happy birthday to him. I would say that the Lou, was it Lou Fest show that the Outkast just did a few years ago?
Like 2 years ago?
That was like one of their best shows in decades.
Yeah. I was there.
That was a must-be-there performance, which unfortunately I was not at it. But
I got to hear it. I was away from it a little bit because I was waiting for...
the bathroom, I'm sure.
1975.
Oh, okay.
The 1975.
I just assumed you were probably stuck in a line for a porta potty somewhere.
No. I didn't have that problem.
Well, happy birthday, Big Boy.
They haven't had an album out in 11 years.
That is true.
What, Outkast?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they don't need to. At this point...
I want to hear some new music from them.
I mean, they could do it, but like, you're always taking a risk when you wait a long time. I mean, like Outkast, they're at a point where if they don't do anything else, they can keep their legendary status. Or you can release some new stuff, and maybe it helps, or maybe it kind of, you know, solidifies that like they are in the past.
They
can
literally, though, just keep going and performing Hey Ya and be done with it.
I mean, they could keep touring with the greatest hits type thing. Yeah, that would be a good idea. But, you know, I mean, like, Jay-Z is still putting out new albums. And, okay, we'll get into the Grammys later, so I won't get too into it. But, like, when Kendrick Lamar was doing his acceptance speech for Rap Album of the Year, and he kept mentioning, you know, Jay-Z was such an influence in this and that, I think you could even tell in Jay-Z's eyes when he's saying that, and just the feeling that it's like, oh, like, I don't see myself winning a Grammy for my album when the dude winning the Grammy is saying, like, how I was one of his... idols and one of his inspirations and stuff, because it's kind of like, for me at least, you can see that the torch has passed, and no matter what Jay-Z puts out now, it's whoever is influenced by that is going to be, you know, the big name or the star, the person winning it, and not necessarily going to be back to, you know, the former glory. True. That's what I'm worried about. I just don't want to see Outkast put something out and have it be like, well, no.
Well, this is what I dislike about hip-hop. Right, is that if you put out an album that's mediocre or not up to your legend or whatever, that people instantly turn on you. I hate that. Because Johnny Cash put out 20 terrible, terrible gospel albums. And then right at the end of his life, he drops an album Cash that's mostly a compilation of other people's music. That's amazing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All produced by Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
Well, it just has to be done the right way. Clearly,
I want to see Outkast really team up with some interesting producers and put some craziness out.
Now, okay, yeah, if Outkast goes like Kanye West on it,
yes,
but in their own way,
yeah,
that would be cool. Because if Outkast was doing some sweet like new age kind of stuff over like some trap beats or something, I could get it. I could be on board with that. So, okay,
and you're going to tell me that Andre 3000. hasn't had anything to say in 11 years. Like, come on.
Well.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, I think he does, but I also know that he, for a fact, wants to stay on, like, the clean cut path right now. And because that's why he doesn't do Outkast now, is because that's too gangster for him at this point. And that's more or less his words, not mine.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, he's got a nice little thing going with acting and being more, politically and just socially involved. And so I think, you know, being remembered as a shirtless guy holding a gun is not what he's good looking for these days. And that's a very tough battle to watch. I mean, we all get older, right? You know? And
that's true.
It's just, look, all right, like, they basically built the mountain of everyone wearing rummage sale clothes. And the fact that they're not standing on top of it, throwing down hits from the mountain I already described,
they
is
already
killing
threw,
me.
They already had a bunch of hits, though. That's
so
the thing.
So what?
I would love a good Outkast album as much as anybody else.
I'd like a bad one. I'd like a mediocre one. I'd like an EP, not even a full LP. Give me a four hit. Give me a bomb track.
Yeah, they could totally drop like a 4 or 5 song EP.
Something.
Okay. Well,
I want musicians. I want musicians I like to make music.
You hold your breath.
There you go.
And here we go.
Well.
All right. We got one final birthday for the day. Going on to 1994. Harry Styles of One Direction and now a solo career is born in Cheshire, England.
Mr. Loverboy of One Direction.
Now, here's the thing. I hate One Direction.
But
Harry Styles' solo work is actually really good.
He's definitely got it.
He did not go the direction that the rest of them went. Like, Zayn went for like the straightforward kind of R&B pop stuff.
I hate that Niall
went straight for the pop route, the Ed Sheeran kind of route.
Yeah.
And then the other ones also did the same thing. So
yeah.
Yeah.
But whoever else is left.
Harry, though, like, he recorded the album, he did his whole acting thing, and then like went back to the album and finished it out. But each song is actually like, it's so not pop. Like, there's elements of country, there's elements of folk, there's, you know, big sort of symphonic songs on there. Good stuff. I'm actually really proud of him as an artist for going in that direction, because the rest of them didn't.
Now, you have made me listen to all of One Direction's solo work.
Okay, I did that?
At one time or another, you've played them for me.
Really?
Yes, you have.
How did I do that?
Brian, how did you not do that?
Because I don't like One Direction.
I know, but it's happened.
Okay, fine, whatever.
If nothing else, you were like, look at this thing I don't like.
Okay.
Like, that doesn't sound like you, right? No, but, okay, so the Harry Styles thing, I have to somewhat agree with you that out of that very specific pool of talent,
yes,
he's kind of emerged as, or that work has emerged as the most quality. However, yes. I don't really think, I think that his music is struggling to find some kind of consistency.
Yeah.
I don't see it as being like, oh, he's incorporating all these wonderful elements. I see it like he's taking a stab at everything and hoping one of them sticks.
Harry Styles kind of reminds me of like a guy who is on the verge of trying to decide if he wants to be like Justin Timberlake or Bruno Mars. Like, he really does, though. And like, he could be his own thing, but he does. He has that feeling like he's waiting for the album that is like his best-selling album.
Yeah.
And then that's going to be the path that he follows. But he's still trying to figure that out. Because right now, he's kind of almost like a Jason Mraz kind of. I mean, he's not like the whole stoner side,
listen to Sign of the Times and like some of the other hits that have come out of that album. I mean, they're good. It's quality music. I'm not saying it's like the best music out there, but it is definitely of a higher quality than a lot of the other stuff that I've heard this year.
And so, he was clearly the most popular member of
easily,
One Direction.
Easily.
Especially with his whole relationship with Taylor Swift, too.
On a weird side note, though, because you said that he was talking about Justin Timberlake. In this last week, Justin Timberlake released a new single that he did in a music video with Chris Stapleton, is that his name? The country artist?
Yeah,
that's one of them.
Yes. So he did a music video with him, and it's really freaking good. Right now, Justin Timberlake is just firing on all cylinders, and he honestly cannot make a wrong move. So I'm quite happy. That's recent news for you. So
it's always good to have new good tunes coming
out. Yes. So I'm Justin Timberlake is also one of those types of people that, like, you know, when NSYNC broke up or whatever, like, they kind of went in different directions and did some solo work. And it was Justin, though, that actually, like, went off and, like, really created his own path. And now he's at a level where he can just create whatever music he wants.
Yeah, it definitely, I think, puts you at an advantage to be the first one to leave a very successful group.
Yeah.
You know?
So I'm quite happy. Not to mention he can seriously just disappear for a few years and then randomly drop a single that becomes number one instantly. So I think, like, him and honestly Beyonce are probably the only two people that can do that right now. So there you go. Moving on up to February 2nd. Greg, what do you got?
In 1993, Willie Nelson settles his $17 million tax debt with the U.S. Internal Revenue Service by paying them $9 million in cash and assets already seized. That's a lot of money, Willie.
The assets that were seized, all weed.
No, there was like...
I know.
They platinum.
They took a bunch of other stuff too, yeah. So yes. But
not Trigger.
No.
It's a lot of money.
Yes. Moving on up to 2011, though, the White Stripes split up after 6 albums, ending their run as one of the most successful rock duos, which is true.
Boo.
Which is amazing, considering that Meg White can't play the drums.
Boo.
Which is a matter of opinion.
That is a matter. I'm kidding. That's the joke. It's just that, like, everybody knows, like, Seven Nation Army, and she, like, literally just hammers the
bass drum.
And, like, that's basically it.
Except for when it gets really heavy, then she adds the crash.
And she adds the crash cymbal and snare.
You know what? It doesn't matter, because that song just rocks.
That is a very rocking song.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, the Black Keys, it's the same way. Their drummer is just kind of a thumper, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he's not the best drummer, but he's in a great band, and so by default, he's a good drummer.
No, but he is actually a pretty good producer too. So there's that.
But Meg White,
she was like they really carved a path for themselves, doing that band, and then she was like I'm kind of done with this, and then they split up, and then she went off and did her own thing, and then of course we know Jack White got married, divorced, started the record label that he's got, I forgot what it's called, like Third Man Records or something like that, and did the raconteurs, yeah. And like a couple of other things, and
bought a legendary studio.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And just to recap, I guess this
and is... he is a true music historian.
Yes.
Like almost like he's like a freaking genius, like the sheer amount of stuff that he remembers. So,
well,
and yeah. In that one documentary, It Might Get Loud, he literally makes a guitar, like, out of a piece of wood, a pickup, and a wire strung between it, and then he plays it with a bottle.
That's okay. Great.
I'm just saying. He does it, and he goes, that's how it's done.
Well, I was just going to give Meg White a little more credit, since it's technically the White Stripes, like we were saying.
Yes.
And, just to give her a little credit, though, her drum beats are simplistic, but like,
So are AC/DC's.
Well, but her drum beats essentially make some of those songs. Like when you think of like My Doorbell or whatever, you know. But in that one specifically, just that do cha do do cha do do cha. Like it's a really simple beat, but it's her way of playing it, yet not playing it totally perfect. That kind of gives it its charm, because then, of course, Jack White turns around and does his kind of like, he's like the Tim Burton of guitar players in a sense, where he just kind of has his like his little bit of odd edge to him, which is what makes him so unique.
Yes.
And I think the combination of that with his quirky ex-wife on drums is what makes it like so different, and then the music videos to go with it too, because who can forget Fell in Love with a Girl, and the whole music video was made out of Legos. You know that one? That was cool too. The White Stripes had something special going. So
yes,
that's gonna
on. I'm sorry, I kid. You know.
Oh yeah, we kid.
But
joke.
Yeah, no. She was a very talented drummer for that band and that style. So
I think the White Stripes are gonna go on the next What I'm Listening To Now podcast. All right. Because
I do want to have one point of contention with the way this was written. And I kind of agonized over this for a moment, then decided it sort of didn't matter, and I could just say this. I don't know that you can call the White Stripes rock, because
how could you not?
Because they don't have an accented 2/4 beat in any song.
Nah.
Yeah,
I think that's why she gets so much shit as a drummer, is because people listen to that and they're like, it's like it's hip hop beats or pop beats, right? In rock.
Mm.
And
when they were active, maybe,
yeah.
But now I don't think anybody would argue that they weren't rock.
True.
Fair enough.
In 2018, we've had bands since then that have helped establish the White Stripes as being a rock band.
Okay.
I think, you know, like, because like the Black Keys is
next
a great
year
example.
They're gonna drop an album, you know it, right? Like they're just gonna, all of a sudden White Stripes are just gonna release an album.
Do it. I dare you.
I'd buy it without listening to it.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest.
Yeah, I probably would too.
I'd definitely check it out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple people like that, and then there's a couple people who I will buy their album without hearing it. But I have to know that they made it first, like Beck.
Mm.
Like Beck, he'll put out like 3 albums in a year and I'll miss 2 of them.
That's true.
You know? Anyway.
That's because he'll do random things just for kicks, you know? But let's go ahead and move on to our last birthdays of the evening.
Yes, 1927. Jazz saxophonist Stan Getz is born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, Stan, in addition to his legendary technical skill and jazz prowess, was also a very difficult person to get along with.
Yes, he was.
And was crazy difficult to work with. So much so that he was routinely banned from the jazz club in Soho, London, known as Ronnie Scott's. In fact, he was banned so often that the manager, Ronnie Scott, usually like would joke about it on stage. And at one time he said, "We've got a sensational new group. Playing at the club in the next 2 weeks. It's tenor sax player Stan Getz, backed and joined by jazz violinist Stuff Smith. The band is called Getz Stuffed Quintet." So if you've ever heard the joke in jazz circles of something, something, something while Stan Getz, that's the word they don't say is while Stan Getz stuffed.
Oh.
Well, there you go.
I like that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And now moving on to our final birthday of the evening.
Sorry.
I just remembered
a really famous one. There's one from a Friars Club roast. They say, yeah, you'll see it tonight. It's George Burns while Stan Getz.
Oh.
Because they were tying two jokes together.
George Burns and Stan Getz, yes. I like that. So, yes, our final birthday of the night goes to 1942 with Graham Nash of the Hollies, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Sometimes Young. And he was born in Blackpool, Lancashire, England. Of course, I've always been a fan of Graham Nash. He is a great, talented singer, and I mean, you cannot listen to a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song and not just be amazed at their harmony and
Absolutely.
How they put songs together.
Oh, yeah.
And it's because, you know, Nash and Stills worked very well at singing like sort of your standard melody and harmony part. And then Crosby was the one who floated around all of their stuff and like just made the songs really pop. And then when you add Young into the mix, it's just like, it just works so well. Not to mention, I mean, his work with the Hollies alone is enough to, you know, make him like a rock legend. It's like, but then to go on and do Crosby, Stills, and Nash, like, just it's great stuff. So, happy birthday to Stan Getz and Graham Nash and all of the other people who had birthdays this week. If you're still alive, I hope it's a great one. If you're dead, I hope wherever you are, it's a great one, too. So you know, that's it. But that's it. That's all we got for this week in music history. This has been Follow the Sound. Of course, if you want to help us out, go to our website, click on that Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Of course, thanks to lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do this show. Go to lineupmedia.fm to find all of our great programming of bunches of shows and different podcasts that I know you will enjoy. And of course, thanks to my great co-hosts, Greg Harvey.
Keep on rocking in the free world.
And Yoda Crumb.
Fear leap to... Yeah, I'm done.
I'm Brian Kroc. Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.